You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudet. 52% of all transgender and non-binary young people in the United States seriously contemplated killing themselves in 2020. More than half thought it would be better to be dead rather than trying to live with rejection, bullying, and being targeted by politicians and activists pushing anti-trans legislation. Now, those are part of the findings of the Trevor Project's third annual national survey on LGBTQIA youth mental health. The results were released in May of 2021. And over the last few years, there has been a growing political tide that's threatened to take away gender-affirming health care for minors, including the advancement of House Bill 675 here in Idaho. Today, we will spend the next hour discussing the ramifications of that bill and the toll legislation like this all across the country is taking on our trans youth community as well as their caregivers. Joining us live today are two licensed professional therapists, Jamie Lang and Diane Piggott, Shannon McLean, mother of a trans child, Shauna Jones, also the mother of a trans child, and Chelsea Gayona Lincoln, Idaho Programs Manager for Legal Voices. Also, Dr. Jeffrey Pennings, a family medicine physician. I want to welcome all of you to the program today. And before we get to all of them, we do want to start our conversation with our own James Dawson. James has been covering House Bill 675 as well as the entire legislative session. So welcome, Jimmy.
Hey, thanks for having me, Gemma.
And another note for our listeners, we will be discussing suicide during today's program. If you or someone you know needs help, please call the Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline. That number is 800-273-8255. Again, 800-273-8255. So first, Jimmy, let's start with the basics. What is House Bill 675?
Yeah, so this was a bill that was introduced kind of late last month. And essentially, it would make it a felony for any doctor to prescribe puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, or perform gender confirmation surgery on a minor. And that penalty could carry up to life in prison. That is the maximum, and there's no floor for that sentence. So, a lot of transgender youth, when they hit puberty or are about to go through puberty, if they want to take these puberty blockers that will, temporarily stall any kind of development in that sense, and then cross-sex hormones, if you're a transgender male, you'll get testosterone. And if you're a transgender female, then you would get estrogen and other hormones as well to essentially develop your body in that way to align with your gender identity.
Mm-hmm. So, Jimmy, some lawmakers said that this is just part of another Idaho law, correct? That was passed back in 2019 that forbids female genital mutilation.
That's one of the arguments. Yeah. So in 2019, like you said, the legislature passed a law forbidding female genital mutilation, which is kind of a traditional practice where traditional, medical practitioners in certain countries in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, surgically remove parts of a girl's vagina, essentially. There's no health benefit to it. It's just traditional practice, which has been condemned by tons of human rights organizations around the world. So, but you're right, this bill would essentially add these conditions to the FGM law, which one of its sponsors from 2019, Representative Carolyn Nilsen Troy, opposed in 2020 when a similar law to do this was introduced.
So, Jimmy, this House Bill 675, it did pass in the House. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was, I believe, earlier this week. It's hard to,
keep
things. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, 2 days ago on March 8th. And, the debate was pretty much party line, I would say. I believe only Republican Representative Fred Wood voted against it. And essentially, you had the bill sponsor, Republican Representative Bruce Skog from Nampa, saying that these sorts of hormones and treatments for gender-affirming care results essentially in sterilizing and, quote, mutilating children. And he says that these kids who are transgender should instead receive, you know, mental health counseling, which they already do before they even mm-hmm. are prescribed these drugs, or, you know, if they choose to undergo surgery as well. So there was a lot of that. He also implied that, you know, this is essentially the same thing as back in the early 20th century when the eugenics movement was going on and, you know, people of color, women who were low income or had, you know, sort of mental conditions were sterilized involuntarily or prisoners as well. For, you know, repeat offenses in some states, you know, Democrats basically said there is no way that we should be weighing in on this extremely personal decision. You had House Assistant Minority Leader Lauren Nekachea saying that an Idaho doctor has had to help three transgender youth, you know, who had recent suicide attempts since this bill was introduced.
Right.
Not to mention that they said Republicans really were, you know, inconsistent when it comes to issues of parental rights and bodily autonomy.
Well, and that, and I found that part to be interesting, Jimmy, because we have had for the last 2 years during this pandemic, a certain party, the Republican Party, really being very firm, very outspoken in regards to parental choice, parental rights, when it comes to masking and it comes to vaccinations in the middle of a worldwide pandemic. Yet, they take the complete opposite approach when it comes to healthcare for their own child. Was there any response from anyone within the Republican Party when this was brought up by lawmakers from the other side?
Well, the only response really was an objection because there were other bills relating to vaccine mandates, mask mandates that have passed the House or were about to be considered later that day. And when a Democrat tried to bring that up, this is kind of inside baseball, but on the House floor, when you're debating, you have to ask permission to refer to pending legislation. And that didn't happen. And so, you know, Republicans just objected to that and kind of shut that down.
Okay. So didn't want to actually have a debate about that. All right. So we do know that this bill now heads to the Senate because it did pass by, as you said, along party lines, pretty much. If passed, it would then go to the governor's office. But Jimmy, there's been some rumblings as of yesterday from certain senators in the state house that this likely will not go anywhere.
As of yesterday, and even as you know, early as about 15 minutes ago, when we're taping this at, you know, noon. So, like you said, yesterday, the Idaho Press Club had its annual, you know, legislative luncheon with leaders, and Senate Pro Tem Chuck Winder said that, you know, he doesn't think that anything is going to happen with this or another bill that would criminalize librarians for, you know, lending out harmful materials, quote unquote, to minors. Anyway, he referred to them as bills as mischief. He said, quote, "I don't think you'll see some of the craziness that the House seems to like to do get very far in the Senate," end quote. But the thing is that just before we were coming on, I saw that the Associated Press reporter Keith Ridler asked Senator Patty Ann Lodge, who chairs the Senate State Affairs Committee, which both of those bills are in right now, says she hasn't decided on holding hearings for at least the 675, House Bill 675. He said that Lodge has been bombarded with emails and, quote, stories that are just heartbreaking. So, you know, obviously Senate Pro Tem Chuck Winder, he does sit on that committee, as do other members of leadership. It's unclear whether, you know, a hearing will be held, but, you know, he doesn't see any kind of big drumbeat to try to get that through the Senate at this time. But it's still up in the air, very much so.
Right. I mean, frankly, until the legislature sine die, Jimmy.
Until they gavel out, exactly.
Yeah. So, Jimmy, this isn't the first time Idaho lawmakers have tried to pass similar legislation, is it?
No. Like I mentioned, back in 2020, there were three bills, one of which was the quote-unquote Save Women's Sports Act, which prevents you know, transgender women and girls from playing on sports teams that align with their gender identity. That one passed. Another prevented transgender people from changing the sex on their birth certificate, which was challenged in court and overturned because it had already been overturned, or at least a similar effort a while ago. And then this one, which is basically a carbon copy of that bill from 2020, got held in a House committee when Republican Representative Greg Cheney, who chaired the Judiciary and Rules Committee, basically said, look, you know, I don't agree with, you know, minors undergoing transition related care, but I think that this bill goes too far and really penalizes parents and doctors who feel like they're just trying to do the best they can for their kids and their patients. And that was really part of this nationwide blitz in state legislatures where they were trying to pass all of these similar types of bills. Idaho was the first to ban, you know, transgender participation in sports, which has now passed in several other states. And then just recently we had, I believe, Texas, Arkansas, and Tennessee have passed these sorts of bills banning gender-affirming care for minors as well. But those are, at least a couple of them, are tied up in the court system right now. And so if this does pass, then I would imagine it certainly would also be headed to a federal courtroom.
Right. So, Jimmy, before I let you go, just to make sure we understand where this bill is, House Bill 675, we are waiting to find out if the Senate will take this up. And as you mentioned, Senator Patty Ann Lodge says she doesn't know what she's going to do yet. Sounds like Senator Winder says he doesn't want to take this bill up. If it is taken up and there is a hearing, what then happens, Jimmy?
That's when people would be able to testify, you know, in favor or opposition of the bill during that committee hearing. They have been taking remote testimony from people over the internet. So that would be an option potentially if the hearing was to go on. And then if it's approved by the committee, it would then go to the floor of the Senate where, you know, it would have an up or down vote. And then I believe you mentioned it earlier in the broadcast that then it would need the governor's signature to become law.
Right. And then from there, likely go into a court system, as you mentioned. Jimmy, thank you so much for talking to us about this and getting us up to date on what this bill is, where it is in the state house. Appreciate all the reporting you do.
Sure thing. Thanks, Gemma.
When we come back, we will have a conversation with our panel of experts about the ramifications of bills like House Bill 675, what this means for our transgender community, for the people that help with their care, whether it's parents, guardians, doctors, and what gender identity really means. Stay with us. More Idaho Matters right now. We will be discussing suicide during today's program. So if you or someone you know needs help, please call the Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline. That number is 800-273-8255. Now, before we dive into the conversation with our guests today, as we were talking with our own James Dawson in the last segment about Idaho House Bill 675, as Jimmy mentioned, that bill was taken up on Tuesday. Lawmakers had some big debate around it. We actually wanted to listen to some of what these lawmakers had to say during this debate on Tuesday. So we're going to start by hearing from the bill's sponsor, Republican Bruce Skagg from Nampa.
This bill is about protecting children. We need to stop sterilizing and mutilating children.
You know, we are way out of our lane making decisions for people about what they're going to look like and how they're going to live their lives for the next 70 years of their days on Earth.
Children as young as 11, 12, 13 are getting puberty blockers, which are inserted surgically to stop them from going through puberty. After about 4 months, they are usually sterilized for life. That's a permanent decision.
Now, some of you may say, well, what's the harm in waiting till you're the age of adulthood? What's the harm in just pushing this decision off till you're 18? A lot of harm, folks, a lot of harm. Allowing puberty to run its course changes the body in profound and irreversible ways.
There are serious side effects to puberty blockers besides sterilization: depression, lowered IQ, loss of bone density, joint problems, and has suspected many other things.
We sit around here and we call ourselves pro-life in this body, but if this bill passes, that will most certainly not be true, because a yes vote will be a noose around the neck of kids who want to live, but not like this. This bill passing will be taking liberty away because it doesn't fit our definition of liberty. And this bill passing will most certainly take away happiness, and it will instead replace it with depression and with sorrow and with the needless death of more trans individuals. We sit here today and we will make life and death decisions for families with this vote.
And by the way, a child's sex is determined not at birth, but at conception, when an X or a Y chromosome fertilizes the egg. XY is male, XX is female. By and large, there are no peer-reviewed, evidence-based medical studies on surgical interventions for gender dysphoria in children. So how should children be treated? This is a mental illness that needs to be treated. I think we can all agree on that. The psychologists, psychiatrists do. How about old-fashioned counseling, talk therapy? That's what's been going on. Traditional psychology methods. The vast majority of gender-confused children, if allowed to go through puberty, outgrow the problem and accept their bodies over time.
But now, in an instance where we don't agree with how families choose to let their children live their lives, we will take their medical freedom away and replace it with felony charges. Freedom for me, but not freedom for thee.
People are struggling with their identity and those questions of identity. It will be the state of Idaho's policy. You're not going to make any of those decisions in those tumultuous teenage years. Instead, you will make those decisions once you reach adult.
Our transgender youth are so incredibly courageous. And I know how stressful it has been for transgender youth and their families as they've watched this bill move through the body. And I hope those children know they are perfect and loved just the way they are, trying to live their truth. They are courageous, but also vulnerable. An Idaho doctor has had to assist 3 transgender youth related to their suicide attempts since this bill was introduced.
Jesus said in red letters, from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For you formed my inward parts. You covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. There are so many people in this world who need to hear that. You are fearfully and wonderfully made. No accidents, no mistakes. I support parental rights. I do not support child mutilation.
The science is settled when the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Pediatric Endocrine Society, and the American Psychiatric Association all agrees that gender-affirming medical care is appropriate and good when families make these decisions together with their medical providers. We need to trust those parents and providers to make these deeply personal decisions.
We just heard from members of the Idaho House during their debate on Tuesday of House Bill 675. The members we heard from, Alana Rubel, Ned Burns, Brent Crane, Lauren Nekachia, and Ben Adams. There is so much to dissect with what we heard there. Also, those lawmakers, just so you know, then voted in favor of the bill, 55-13. And as we heard earlier, this may or may not be stalled in the Senate. Our panel today, Jamie Lang and Diane Pigott, Shannon McLean, mother of a transgender child, Shauna Jones, also the mother of a transgender child, Chelsea Gayanoa-Lincoln, Idaho Programs Manager for Legal Voices, and Dr. Jeffrey Pennings, a family medicine physician. And I should note that Jamie and Diane are both licensed therapists. Dr. Pennings, I want to start the conversation with you, because what we just heard from some of these lawmakers was about how, your sex, whether you are male or female, begins at conception. A girl, XX chromosomes, a boy, XY chromosomes. I would ask you then, where does a child born intersex fall into this conversation?
Intersex, like XXY, and it's something that we pay close attention to when we're seeing a patient as a new consult, whether it's a totally new patient or being referred to us for gender-affirming care and their gender dysphoria, as something that we look into for, you know, do they have any history of intersex or any phenotypic or physical features that would suggest intersex, because that is an important thing to keep in mind as we're exploring gender dysphoria with a patient, to make sure that something like intersex is not contributing to what's going on. And if there's any concerns for that, usually we're getting either pediatric endocrinology if it's a pediatric patient or adult endocrinology involved and genetics involved to kind of help coordinate that patient's care. So it's, you know, I think as a lot of you guys know, gender dysphoria is, you know, generally a multidisciplinary collaborative effort amongst a number of healthcare providers, some of them physicians, some of them licensed therapists. And there's these, it is interprofessional and collaborative because sometimes gender dysphoria is complicated, and it's important that we have a lot of different people kind of helping coordinate this care with the families, is what I would have say.
Dr. Jennings, for people who may not fully understand, because I think it's important during this conversation that we all get educated, what is gender dysphoria? How would we, just in layperson's terms, describe what that is?
So gender dysphoria is going to be basically when there is like an incongruence between the assigned birth sex of a person and then the sex that they feel like they actually are. So it's a spectrum. So there are, the amount of dysphoria varies patient to patient, and the dysphoria can be heightened by stage in certain stages in one's life. So we start making our first impressions and understandings of gender around age three, when adolescents or children start understanding, okay, this is my perception of a boy, this is my perception of a girl. And then when we get to age five or so, they have a little bit more of an understanding of, okay, girls can maybe grow up to be moms and boys can maybe grow up to be dads. And then when we get to age six to seven, there's more understanding about the constancy of gender. In terms of if I am a boy and I dress in a pink shirt, it doesn't make me a girl. So we start making, we start understanding gender at a really young age, which why I don't think these arguments carry any weight when you have people saying we can't let kids be involved in coordinating their transgender care because their brains don't stop developing till they're age 25. That bears no weight in any of this for me, because most kids have a very strong understanding of gender and start making that understanding around age three and then on to age seven, when it becomes pretty permanent and solid. And I describe it as a spectrum again, because children are going to have varying levels of dysphoria and different periods of their life as they're understanding more about gender. And then especially when they go on to puberty, when we do see a lot of people actually present to our clinics, is because if they haven't presented before, their dysphoria is significantly heightened by the experiences of developing secondary sex characteristics in puberty. So it doesn't surprise me that sometimes we see kids for the first time around pubertal age, because that dysphoria just takes off. But it's not uncommon that they come in much earlier, because as they're understanding more and more about gender, they're going to have periods of dysphoria too. So it's just whenever they end up coming in.
So Shannon and Shauna, I'd like to bring both of you into the conversation, since you were parents of transgender children. And I think it's interesting what Dr. Pennings just brought up about gender identity and how young children are. I have two children, and both of my children at very young ages. I mean, I remember very specifically, you know, when they were little, playing with boys and girls, having no difference. And my oldest son, his best friend up until he was three was a girl, right? And then all of a sudden, around 3-4 years old, they were both, you know, both my boys were like, I'm a boy, you know, I mean, very much like I am a boy. By the time you get to kindergarten, then all of a sudden you start to see, like, you know, the boys play with the boys, the girls play with the girls. I mean, they know the difference. And so when we have these conversations of children don't know, they do know when it comes to their gender and how they feel. So Shannon, can I start with you? Tell us a little bit about your family's journey.
Sure. So for us, Luke did not come out to us until he was 12. And so it was a little bit different. It wasn't something that we were aware of when he was a toddler or particularly small. There were a few comments prior to that where it was like, gosh, Mom, I wish I could be more like you. Kind of like, I wish I could be a girl like you. And I really didn't understand the comments at the time. And, but really when, you know, he was just happy being a kid and not thinking about those things that much until it became really apparent that now was the time to think about that. You know, how girls behaved in school versus boys and not relating to that well. And so at 12, you know, like almost right on the dot, that's when he made it known, you know, how he was feeling. And for us as parents at the time, it was, felt really overwhelming. And also just, you just know that you need more information. You know, you need to support your child right off the bat. Yes, you can cut your hair. Yes, you can dress in your brother's clothes. You know, none of that was really a question so much as just knowing that we really needed to understand it better to support our child in the best manner possible. And the second you read the statistics in terms of suicide rates and depression for these kids, there was no choice. Like, that told me everything I needed to know in terms of how to proceed. And the fact that I did need to bring in professionals to support him, to support us, and make sure that this was, in fact, you know, his truth, so to speak. And that's what we did. And I don't regret a second of it.
Yeah. And Shauna, what about your family's journey?
We had a similar experience in that I think growing up, my son, his best friend was the little neighbor boy across the street. And we didn't have a lot of gendered stuff at our house. And so really puberty is when the dysphoria and the discomfort really hit him. He did not feel comfortable in his body. He had a suicide attempt early in his teens. And then he came out later in his teens as transgender. And then looking back, it made sense. He didn't come out to us until he was an older teen. But yeah, I think for a lot of trans kids, puberty and adolescence really can kick that discomfort in their body into high gear and make them aware in ways that they weren't as younger children.
Mm-hmm. And I want to bring both Diane and Jamie into the conversations. You were both licensed professional therapists working with transgender youth and their families. You know, Diane, can you talk about, you know, these differences and why it's so important for us to understand it, and differences when we talk about gender versus what sex we are biologically and even our sexuality? Because it seems that with these culture wars going on, we tend to lump them all in one pot.
Absolutely. And that is definitely what has been done for, well, let's say centuries. In the far distant past, it was not. And what you've got is gender is how you feel about yourself in a framework of largely often male, female, or in between, or neither. I know that's quite a mouthful for the brain, isn't it? And it's a sense of self. It's who you are. Sex is a biological, often, statement of what traits are expressed, what traits are there genetically. They do not have to be the same thing at all. And then sexuality is who you're attracted to, who you have an affinity for. And even that is becoming a more nuanced situation, because there are many people who do not accept for themselves or want to assert a male or female, man or woman identity. And so it's just the main thing, the main important thing, obviously you can tell I just had a latte. The main important thing is to realize that one is a sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sense of self that is often applied or interpreted by society, by people around us. Sex is a theoretically more easily defined set of physical circumstances. And when the discussion is in the wider part of the public, it seems to always boil down to genitals.
Right.
Though there is so much more.
So, does Jamie,
that answer your question?
It does. And Jamie, I'd like for you to talk about this idea, as we heard from some lawmakers, about, you know, this idea of where, you know, a child getting medical intervention, hormone blockers, or even to the point of getting sex reassignment surgery, and these lawmakers saying they need to have mental health therapy. These kiddos do get that. And I would assume, so please correct me if I am wrong, because this is about educating all of us, is that these would be some of the first steps, is that these youth get mental health care.
Yeah. Thanks, Gemma. Thanks for having us all on here. You know, gender affirming care is not limited to just trans children or trans folks. Everybody needs gender affirming care. And it is a standard of care that mental health professionals walk with their clients as they make these decisions. It is not our job to impose a binary view of gender or anything like that. Our job is to provide gender affirming, all encompassing, loving care to these kiddos who are in the most vulnerable positions of their lives. No one in the mental health profession is hoping to push children in any direction other than the direction that they need. It is our job to sit with our clients and believe their truth and believe their experiences. That is our job. We have no agenda other than to believe our clients.
I want to reintroduce our panel quickly, Jamie Lang and Diane Pidgett. They are both licensed professional therapists. Shannon McLean is a mother of a trans child, as is Shauna Jones. Chelsea Gayona Lincoln is Idaho Programs Manager for Legal Voices. And Dr. Jeffrey Pennings is a family medicine physician. Chelsea, we have not chatted yet, and I would like to bring you into the conversation to talk about the legal impacts of bills like House Bill 675, as well as other laws that have already gone into effect in regards to our transgender community. For example, the fight to not allow transgender youth to play sports, in particular transgender female. Can you talk about the legalities of bills like this? Because it seems that there are constitutional issues.
Yes, there are absolutely constitutional issues. I think that the discussion around especially the trans athlete ban is definitely more nuanced, bringing in conversations of Title IX and other parts of legalities that exist. But when it comes to items like this transgender affirming healthcare ban, it really is stepping out of line with what we know is actually legal. And the sponsors know this. We've told them this. We've let them know this on multiple occasions, that denying or limiting access to medical care based on an individual's gender identity is a legal discrimination under the federal law. the Bostock decision makes it really clear. And additionally, offering a type of medical care such as puberty blockers to cisgender youth who are experiencing precocious puberty while denying access to that exact same medication to trans and gender diverse youth is going to violate the Equal Protection Clause. And finally, it definitely interferes with a parent's fundamental rights to raise and care for their children. It's an Idaho state statute that they have an unalienable right to be able to raise and guide their children's destiny and upbringing, and that the state has a very invested interest in protecting that right. And additionally, hospitals who deny gender access to affirming care, the Federal Health and Human Services could potentially take away federal funding at a time when Idaho hospitals were just in a crisis standards of care. So this is something that could affect all Idahoans. A slippery slope, to be sure.
And then when we think about part of this House Bill 675, Chelsea, that talks about it would make it a felony for a parent to take a child out of state to get medical affirming care. We have a constitutional right to the right to travel. So that flies in the face of that as well.
Absolutely. And not only that, but now we're getting into possible HIPAA violations. We've had questions from parents around custody issues. If they have shared custody that's across state line, who's going to get in trouble? Is someone going to get in trouble? I have parents wondering if they have to sign over legal custody to somebody who's outside of the state to ensure their kids can continue getting gender affirming care. This really is a slippery slope for a mess, and they're conflating this kind of practice of gender affirming care with female mutilation. And it's really disheartening and disturbing. And I think another thing that came up on floor debate that also hasn't been talked about is they started to say the quiet things out loud when Representative Young conflated this bill to a pro-life bill to ensure the next generations would be brought into this world. And I think that kind of gives some indications of some of the true intentionality beyond just trying to eradicate LGBTQ plus people from our communities.
Well, and Chelsea, I think for a lot of people, it is difficult to understand having lawmakers who bring a bill like this, who pass it overwhelmingly along party lines, to take away parental rights when, A, as we mentioned in the beginning of the show, this same party has fought fiercely for parental rights when it comes to masking and COVID vaccines. We also have a law in the state of Idaho that gives medical exemptions. That gives religious exemptions, for families to decide whether to get their child medical care if they are sick. This seems to fly in the face of everything that this party says that they stand for. How do we legally wrap our brains around that?
I think sometimes we have to step out of the bubble of trying to legally understand what they're doing, because we've seen multiple times that they have no issue relocating millions of dollars into some sort of litigation fund so that they can pass these unconstitutional laws as a means to rally their base before primaries and fundraising. We already have multiple discriminatory laws on our books. We have fought long and hard, and they still refuse to add the words to the Idaho Human Rights Act. So we know that legality is not necessarily their strong suit, or certainly not what their intentionality is. This is about control. This is about political power. And we've brought that forward to them, that this definitely contradicts what they say when it comes to parental rights, that they're going to allow parents to refuse life-saving care to their child based on religion, but then they're not going to allow parents to give life-saving care to their children based on the lawmaker's religion. So I think sometimes we just have to step out of the bubble of trying to make sense of it and watch it for the roller coaster of madness that it is, and engage in the best possible ways to stop it on multiple fronts.
Dr. Pennings, we have to take another break here in a moment, but I do want to have you explain what gender-affirming medical care looks like, in particular, this idea of puberty blockers. We heard in that piece that we played earlier from one lawmaker saying that after a couple of months, puberty blockers cause sterilization. And so it seems that it's irreversible and also that minors are getting sex reassignment surgery in Idaho. A, is that happening? And B, talk to us about what puberty blockers are and if they are reversible.
Yeah, that's a great question. The ideal scenario of gender-affirming care for pediatric patient, which is going to be the ideal scenario for any transgender patient, because the earlier we capture this, the earlier we have multiple professionals, including behavioral health, involved to protect this child from increased suicidality and treat depression and anxiety. But we can act and prevent the development of these secondary sexual characteristics that are most distressing for these patients. So the most ideal situation would be a child presenting in either before puberty or very early puberty. Ideally, we kind of look at this in terms of Tanner stages. As a child develops and goes through puberty, they go through these different tiers of Tanner stages for breast development and penile development and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we're intervening early on in puberty and diagnosing their gender dysphoria, exploring that gender dysphoria with them and their families, and then coordinating their care. And after multiple visits, a full physical exam, we would consider starting puberty blockers in a patient. And this is a process, and we go through consents and talk to the family about all the different possibilities and what the plan is and what things we're going to be monitoring super closely while they're on puberty blockers. But then if we're all in agreement on that plan and feel like that's a safe plan for the patient, we would move forward. So the puberty blocker medication that we use is a medication called Lupron, and it works at the pituitary level to suppress and basically kind of turn off puberty. And they're on these injections usually about every 3 months while they're in a puberty blocking stage. And we've used these medication or this medication for decades in treatment of precocious puberty, which is when a child rapidly develops puberty early on in life. So maybe a kid that's 4 or 5 years old that is starts having their menses or these sex characteristic changes. And we do know in those kids that are on Lupron for a number of years. Once they stop, they go on and have normal puberty. So this is not indifferent to that. So if a child was to start puberty blockers or Lupron for treatment of their gender dysphoria, we would basically be putting an off switch on puberty and developing those very distressing sex characteristics for them, giving the parents time to learn more about transgender medicine, the transgender community, and engage with their child, and give the child time to, you know, make sure that their gender dysphoria stabilizes, which we often see happens, and give them time to explore their gender identity while we're working with other professionals, including behavioral health. So it's so important that we do this. If for whatever, the parents have control here, the parents are the ones that are working with the physician to sign the consent. And if they wanted to stop the puberty blockers or the child wanted to stop the puberty blockers, puberty would resume within 3 to 6 months. So this is not these statements about injecting these permanent things that causes permanent sterilization after 3 months of treatment or 6 months of treatment. They're just absurd. They're not true. So I don't know where they're getting that. We've seen these medications used again for decades. You're putting a pause to give the child time and the parents' time and the physician's time to take the best care of this kiddo. And when the time is right, which usually the earliest for most people would be considering at age 16, switching from puberty blockers to hormone replacement therapy, we might go that route. Sometimes people wait a little bit longer. And then in your question about
sex reassignment surgery.
That is not happening in pediatric patients, at least in Idaho, and I don't think in the United States. More abroad, internationally, I think there are some countries that have done sex reassignment surgeries before the age of 18. But that doesn't apply for us here.
I know that we have only touched the surface on this. And I want to thank all of you for coming in today. I know there is so much more to talk about and to make sure that we continue these conversations. But I do appreciate the fact that you have all been willing to talk about this and to educate all of us on maybe some issues that we didn't know about or understand. With that said, I have about 1 minute left, and I want to leave it with either Shannon or Shauna or both of you. As parents of transgender children, what do we all need to know? What do we need to be educated on? Shannon, I'll give you about 30 seconds, and then I'll go to Shauna.
Oh, gosh. There's so much, but one thing that Diane made a point is that being transgender does not make my child mentally ill. And I would vehemently disagree that with that generalization that I think a lot of people make. My child is a straight A student who's doing really beautifully in life due to the fact that he's got a real stable, loving home. And he happens to be transgender as well, but he's a whole human being.
And Shauna, about 20 seconds.
Okay, I would say the same. My gender-affirming care saved my son's life. He is a happy, healthy, productive member of society and adult because he got gender-affirming care. It absolutely was a matter of life and death for him and has made all the difference. And if we could just see trans people as people who deserve all the love and compassion and health care as everyone else, that would be half the battle.
Thank you all so much. Thank you for sharing your experiences. Thank you for sharing your expertise. We will, of course, hopefully have more on this important conversation as we move through the legislative session. I'm Gemma Gaudette. I want to thank all of our guests. I want to thank all of you. We will be back here tomorrow.